I'm Piers Linney. Join me for Rethinking Business, a new podcast series brought to you by NatWest. Let's face it, the path to business success is rarely straightforward. That's why in this series, we're hearing from businesses who are thinking differently. My guest this week is Daniel Price, the founder of the personalised children's gift brand, My First Years.
For us, we just got to keep developing our systems to stay ahead of the game.
That's Rethinking Business by NatWest. Subscribe now.
I'm Molly Wansell.
And I'm Geoffrey Wansell.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we have been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
And that's what's prompted us to launch this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wansell, and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wansell.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back.
And we're on to our second podcast of 2018.
We are indeed.
Here we are. As everyone could probably hear, I'm not very well. I almost totally lost my voice earlier in the week. Well, actually on Friday, Saturday, Sunday. But I thought I would still pitch up today.
Fortunately, I haven't lost my voice.
Luckily, Dad does most of the talking, so that's okay. How are you doing, Dad?
I think I'm doing pretty well, actually.
Any news?
Worked on my novel. I've read an extremely good, the new James Lee Burke called Robichaux, which is, Lee Burke is an absolute genius, probably the greatest contemporary American novelist in any genre, not just in crime, but he is an absolute poet and weaves the most fantastic Dickensian spells around the bayou of southern Louisiana, where he lives in New Iberia, and where he has a mate called Cleet Purcell. But this one is particularly good. It's called Robichaux, and it's the 21st novel in the Dave Robichaux series, because he's invented the most spectacular hitman, a contract killer, who says, everybody calls me Smiley, and he wears red tennis shoes. And he runs through this novel. You don't meet him until almost halfway. But my goodness me, what an absolutely unforgettable character. And, of course, I won't spoil the story for anyone who reads it. He plays an integral part in the second half and in a very major way. But it also is tied up in all kinds of southern politics and what the South meant. Lee Burke is very interested, for example, that the Confederate side in the American Civil War.
Oh, yeah.
Were not fighting to enslave their fellow Americans. They were fighting a different cause. And part of the theme of the book is the shadows and the ghosts of Confederate soldiers who haunt that part of southern Louisiana. It begins with a description of them and it ends with a description of them. It's very, very moving. It's much, much more than a crime novel.
Fantastic. Top recommendation there.
Yes, I will be repeating that recommendation in print. I really do think it's very, very good. He's 81 now, but he's absolutely still at the top of his game. Very considerable storytelling and incredible characters.
Fantastic. I'm trying to think if it doesn't even feel like that long since we recorded the last one, and it's been 2 weeks. I'm trying to think if I'd achieved anything. I haven't really. I've been taking it quite easy because I haven't been very well. And then, but next week I'm going to the theatre 3 times. I was meant to go to the theatre last night to Northampton to see Passage to India that my client Manu is in, but I wasn't well enough to go. So Kelly went in my stead. Next week I have going to see Beginnings, which is a play that transferred from the National to the West End. I'm going with Miles. And then my client Tom Mothersdale is press night for John at the Dorfman, which is a new Annie Baker play, which is press next week. And then the press night for another play, 2 of my clients are in there or here at the Park Theatre.
Oh, yes. Is that the Finsbury Park?
Yes, theatre. I actually have never been.
No, I have. My friend Giles goes quite often up there.
Yeah.
And speaks very highly of it. I've been to quite a lot of the fringe theatres, but that's one I haven't got to.
Yeah. You've even been up to the Arcola, haven't you? You saw something with Giles at the Arcola.
Yeah. Yes, it was, and jolly good it was too. It's a nice little theatre.
Yeah, I like it there.
No, I've seen, as ever, plenty of Netflix.
What have you been watching?
The Sinner.
Oh, you took my recommendation.
I saw all 8 episodes.
And you liked
it? I thought it was terrific.
Stacey was meant to meet on that, but she couldn't do it, which is really annoying.
It's a terrific piece. And Bill Pullman, whom I think is wonderful anyway, is excellent, absolutely excellent in it.
Oh, good. Okay, good. Excellent. I can't. What have I been watching? A lot of Catfish, Dad, which is not a programme that has any kind of integrity to it at all in any way. It's a sort of like, did I talk about it last week? How much Catfish I was watching. No, Catfish is a documentary that was made about a man who falls in love with someone on the internet, and then when he finds out who she is, it turns out she wasn't who she said she was. And it stemmed from the back of it, this a documentary series made by the man who was catfished, as they call it, it's now a verb.
Yes.
And lots of people write in and they get their... And these two men, Neve and Max, come and do research into the person they're talking to on the internet to find out if they're real or not.
Yes. I have heard the word catfish.
That is the general premise.
Yes. It's not an unfamiliar one. There are quite a lot of those kind of stories around, aren't
there?
Oh,
lots. They said they've managed to do 7 series since the documentary came out.
Well,
so.
it's a very good subject, because people can pretend to be whomever they want to.
Exactly.
After all, it's anonymous.
Yeah,
they can put up entirely false photographs. They can, men can be women can be men. Transsexuals can be transsexuals. It is an extraordinary phenomenon.
I know. Exactly.
And of our times.
Almost exclusively, people aren't who they say they are.
No. There's a very interesting description, which I, funnily enough, came across this week, which, in a sense, is no one is ever quite what they seem. And a lot of what we talk about in these podcasts is how unlikely the offenders are. Today, however, this is a very much more kind of, it does what it says on the tin offender. This is not an offender hiding in plain sight.
No, this is true, so we should get on to it. So this week we are doing, just for a bit of clarity here, his name is Dale Cregan, but we were just discussing whether he ought to be called Cregan or Cregan, as it's one E.
It's one E. It's C-R-E-G-A-N, first name Dale, born in Manchester on the 6th of June, 1983.
Hold on. I'm just going to intro this properly. So anyway, we're going to call him Cregan. You can call him Cregan. Maybe if you're in Manchester, you probably would call him Cregan. And so this is today's subject, the one-eyed gangster.
Dale Cregan, or Cregan, was born in June 1983 in Droylsden. It's an East Manchester suburb. He was a particularly unpleasant young man. He was a gangster 101 from the very beginning. Even at school, he dealt in cannabis and then graduated to cocaine. He was a wiry boy who became recognised hard man. He took pleasure in violence. He was, in that sense, psychopathic. He relished his reputation for being an enforcer, for example, which, in other words, you do the violent wet work, as they say in America, for gangster families.
He was just like a serious bad guy.
Yes. He was also a member of one of the two competing gangster families in East Manchester, the Shorts and the Atkinsons. He was the Atkinsons' enforcer.
When was this?
We're talking about between 2001 and 2012.
Do they still exist, those gangster families? Yeah.
They don't have quite the sway that they once had, because Cregan bought such a terrible reputation to the families that the Manchester police took a greater and greater interest in them, and the power that they had, which in many ways was comparable to the craze in London in the 60s, the craze and the Richardsons, the two big gangs in London.
Yeah.
But these two families had been feuding really on and off from 2001 when Cregan was only 18.
How do we know how he got kind of looped into the gang?
I think he befriended Leon Atkinson, one of the younger of the Atkinson family. And the Atkinsons and the Shorts were the other group. It was always about not respecting one another. You know, I think at one point someone was slapped because he looked at another member of the family in the wrong way.
Mm.
And on another occasion, one of the Shorts was pushed off his bike and had his throat cut, but he survived. And the Short family always thought it was Cregan, or Cregan and others who worked for the Atkinsons.
And just when you say rival gangster families, was that like they both dealt drugs,
yes,
or like they both?
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. They both had their hands in protection, drugs, smuggling, anything that could make them money. Armed robbery. Cregan relished his reputation for armed robbery. You are talking about people for whom crime is a way of life. This is quite unlike some of the other cases we've talked about, in which you have what you might describe as a totally distorted personality. But it's not a lifestyle. There are one or two it was a lifestyle for, but this one is a particular kind of gangster. Anyway, the Atkinsons of the Shorts sort of made it up.
Okay, so their rivalry was put on hold.
Yeah, it was put on hold in about 2008. I think they decided that actually there was no point in shouting, taking lumps out of one another.
Mm.
And things settled down. But in May 2012, they all kicked off again. It kicked off when a bottle was thrown. And one of the Short, the matriarch of the Short family, said, "I'll tell my boys, you're all dead."
I think we said it was the women that started the rekindled
it
the,
it, well, it was the
rekindled the feud.
Yeah. The important thing I think to remember about Cregan is that this is really the only family that he had.
Mm. So he felt he ought to protect them.
Yes, and also this was his lifestyle.
Probably didn't know any other way of... Yeah.
Okay, so the other amusing or ironic things is that one was a Manchester City supporter.
They were rival based on football rivalry as well.
Yes, although this has nothing to do with hooliganism. This is simply one of the things about the family. Anyway, in May 2012, this kicks off again. But the Shorts have decided that they're going to have a reunion to celebrate the success of Manchester United in the Cotton Tree pub in Droylsden. Now, this is the opportunity that the Atkinsons have been waiting for.
Because they're all going to be together in one place.
They're all going to be together in one place. And so a preemptive strike is orchestrated by Cregan.
Right.
Against the Shorts, who are all in the Cotton Tree pub on the 25th of May, when celebrating the success and being also presumably celebrating their, how can one put it, their success as a gangster family. On Friday the 25th of May, so the Shorts were in the Cotton Tree pub in Droylsden, where Cregan came from. Now, it's also worth remembering that Cregan was a particularly malevolent-looking man. He had only his left eye disappeared. Now,
yeah, we've called him the one-eyed gangster.
Yeah, well, there are two stories about how he lost his left eye. The one he liked to tell was that it was lost in a fight with a man with a knuckle duster on one of his many trips to Thailand.
Okay.
The police have always believed that it was actually taken out by the Shorts. Which accounted for his particular dislike of the Short family.
Yeah, well, I mean, that would make sense.
Well, he replaced it, not with a glass eye like that we might look exactly like one of yours. He just replaced it with a black piece of black glass, a black...
Terrifying. So it just looked like a hole.
Yeah, well, exactly. And he was a most peculiarly looking man. That's hence the phrase, the one-eyed gangster.
Yeah.
So all the Short family are in the pub. A man wearing a balaclava, to quotes, can see his features, though I would have thought you could probably see his
the
black
eye. Yeah.
Walks in and using a Glock, self-loading Glock, fires a volley of 7 shots. He kills one of the shots, Martin. The father, David, by pure chance, was in the loo.
Martin was his son.
Martin was his son. And Cregan goes in, a volley of shots.
Sprays the bullets everywhere.
Sprays the bullets everywhere. Actually kills Martin. Dad's in the loo. Obviously hears the shots.
Comes out.
Comes out and has to cradle his dying son.
So
we now are in full-scale battle mode. Not surprisingly, Cregan is a suspect. He's rounded up, rather like Claude Rains rounded up the usual suspects in Casablanca, but there is no firm evidence. He's released. Cregan by now.
Also, they're not going to, not like the shorts are going to be like, it was him, because that you can't do that in gangster stuff, can you?
Well, you can, because you know pretty much who your enemies are.
Yeah.
Anyway, the point was that Cregan's motivation is now he's convinced that David Short, the father who has survived, is going to extract a terrible revenge.
On him. On him.
Yes, because he will have learnt by now, because that's the way the underworld works, about who pulled the trigger. Cregan becomes obsessed by the fact that David Short is going to do terrible things to him. He tells various associates that Short has threatened to rape his child, kill his sister, all manner of, I mean, probably over-the-top threats, but nevertheless, they're real to Cregan, in Cregan's mind.
Yeah.
So Cregan makes himself scarce. He goes to Thailand, which he has a habit of going to. When he comes back in June that year, he's arrested when he gets off the plane. Once again, there isn't enough concrete evidence. He's released on police bail. Now, that's significant because 3 days after his release on police bail, he goes to David Short's house with a colleague and shoots him. Well, in fact, he does more than shoot him. He pursues him through the house, firing 9 shots. In the end, killing him in the garden, in the back garden. This is Friday the 10th of August 2012. But not content with killing David Short, he then produces a hand grenade. He has a collection of hand grenades.
What's he doing with a hand grenade?
He has rather a large number of hand grenades, which he's accumulated for himself.
Where do you keep those?
I think he kept them in the garage, to be honest. Anyway, he puts a hand grenade under the body
of
David Short.
He does not.
And pulls the pin.
That's horrible.
Which effectively, of course, destroys David Short's body. Boom. Now,
that is really bad.
It is one of the very few instances that a hand grenade has ever featured in a criminal trial in this country. It's very, very unusual.
Yeah, well, that's also like that's because he's trying to destroy evidence, or because he's just like vile.
Vile. That's right. Depraved would be equally good. He is a genuinely psychopathic personality. He sees no problem. I'll wipe this person off the face of the earth.
Threatening to do stuff to him that he might not even have done.
Yes. Or let's leave it rest. I mean, at one point, David Short did say to his partner, I've decided to leave it to the police. Let the Greater Manchester Police deal with it. I'm not going to pursue this issue about my son's death. But nevertheless, that didn't impact on Cregan. Once again, Cregan disappears. He goes on a sort of road trip. Takes himself off to a bit of Scotland, Anglesey, all manner of places.
Anglesey is a weird choice.
Yes, but
I mean, it's very beautiful.
Yeah, I've never been there.
I've been there.
Yeah.
There's a butterfly farm there.
That's right, there is. That's exactly right. But all the time he's, quotes, on the run, he is harbouring a terrible resentment at the Greater Manchester Police for not offering him and his partner and his child protection from the Shorts. Now,
why would they?
Well, I couldn't agree more. Why would they? But nevertheless, you have to remember you're talking about a man whose vision of society is totally different from yours and mine.
Okay.
He believes that the police are there to protect him just as much as us. Well, hang on a minute. You make your living as a gangster, one shape or form or another. Why would you get all that much protection? Answer, I deserve it. I have a very inflated opinion of myself. I'll come back to that. One of the fascinating things about the character of Cregan is that he has a grandiose impression of his own importance.
Well, we've come across that before.
We have. But this time, it takes a really horrible turn. We now move to September 2012. It's a Tuesday morning, bright, the 18th of September. Cregan has decided to take his revenge on the Greater Manchester Police.
For something they haven't done that only he thinks they ought to do, yes. And he never asked them to do, no. I'm guessing.
No. He's on police bail and is a suspect in the killing of the Shorts, but never mind. He is going to take his revenge on the Greater Manchester Police.
Good.
Now, we're talking about distorted reality here, aren't we?
Big time.
Okay. He calls the police using a false name and says that someone has just thrown a concrete block through the window of the council house he's squatting in, and he's just run off across the fields. This is a place called Mottram. The police say, quite correctly, we'll send officers to investigate. The two officers who are sent are women police constables, Fiona Bone, who's 32, and Nicola Hughes, who's 23.
See Bon Iver live at All Points East. Don't miss Bon Iver live Sunday the 2nd of June at Victoria Park, London. With special guests Mac DeMarco, First Aid Kid, John Grant, Ezra Furman and many more. Tickets available now at allpointseastfestival.com.
They do not know, of course, what they're going to confront.
No.
They park outside the house. The address has been given. It's very eerily, all the windows have been whitewashed, so you can't see in.
Okay.
Okay. Cregan is waiting for them. He sees them pull up, sees them get out of the...
He's still in the house.
He's in the house.
Is he actually squatting in it, or does he live there?
No, he's squatting in it. He uses it to his advantage.
Okay.
Okay, so this is effectively an ambush.
Yeah.
As they get out of the car, walk towards the house, it's quite a short drive, he opens the front door. And he's adapted the Glock 21, which he used to kill David Short, to a expanded magazine of 32 bullets. He opens fire without a moment's warning.
While they're walking up towards the house?
While they're walking towards the house.
Oh no, this is so sad. I can't bear it.
It is unbearably sad, actually. These are two unarmed, uniformed women police constables. Cregan opens the door and starts firing. He hits the younger, Hughes, first. Effectively, she turns, obviously, you know, fear.
Yeah, you would.
She turns.
Yeah.
The bullet lodges in her back, paralysing her. She falls to the ground. The other one, Bone, the older, makes a valiant, gallant attempt to get away. She runs. He runs after her.
Oh, God.
She tries to stop him with a taser. It doesn't work. He shoots 21 shots.
That's terrible.
21 shots. Altogether, in a space of 31 seconds, he expends the full magazine, 32 bullets. But the worst of it, a poor Bone is eventually, of course, killed. He returns to Hughes, who is lying there, unable to move and unable to say anything, and shoots her three times in the head.
That's awful.
And then
that's so sadistic and horrible.
Then gets out his trademark hand grenade and blows her body up.
Oh, no, he doesn't. Not just that one girl, the younger girl.
That's the one. Now, There is no...
I hope he's in prison for a really long time. All the time he has left ever in the whole world.
It is the most sadistic, brutal, savage attack that you could possibly imagine to these innocent, well-meaning police officers. It is a crime of such magnitude that it's very, very difficult to think of anything that quite in that same... Right, after all, Bone and Hughes had gone there apparently to sort out a crime, and instead they find themselves victims.
Yeah, they just turned up totally unknowing, and he just, yeah, like you said, ambushed them, just took them down for no reason.
For no reason, except...
They weren't.
The bizarre thought that the Greater Manchester Police...
I know, but they weren't in the gang, were they? They were just...
No, they were not. Now, Cregan reveals his true colours.
Why? What is he? He's on the run now, though, shouldn't
well,
he?
Well, he reveals his true colours. He knows perfectly well that it's almost certain that an awful lot of armed policemen are going to turn up pretty quickly.
Yeah, he's done the worst thing ever.
Yeah, and he's not going to... how can I put it politely... He's unlikely to get out of a shootout with the Manchester Police alive.
No.
So what does he do? He leaves the Glock, gets in a stolen car and drives to the police station and says, I've just shot two police people.
You are kidding me.
Because he doesn't want to die in a shootout. This is a man who's both grandiose and also cowardly.
What does he want? That's crazy. Why would he do that?
Well, he would do it because he didn't want to be... you know, trapped in a house in a suburb of Manchester with outside 16 police marksmen, only two pleased, who would have been only too pleased to...
Shoot him down.
So I think that does reveal a lot about Cregan's true colours.
Oh, that's pathetic. That's pathetic.
Yeah, but here he is. He's in the police station. He's dressed in a hoodie and a pair of shorts. He looks for all the world like, you know, your local, friendly local drug dealer. But he has nevertheless committed the most obscene act.
Also, he's blown up a grenade. Like, I assume that that's like a loudish explosion.
A very, very loud explosion. There can be no doubt that
shots are fired. So, like, that's quite a quick turnaround.
It's a very quick turnaround. I mean, we're not talking about hours here. We're talking about minutes.
He's literally shot them in 31 seconds, put the grenade under, pulled the grenade, got in a car and driven to the police station, all in the space of 4 minutes or something.
Well, all in the space of minutes, not in the space of hours.
No.
Interestingly, when he's walking into the police station, in a very typical and modern manner, he's on the mobile phone.
Who's he phoning? His friend, telling them he's going to go to prison. Yeah. Hey, love, I just killed two police officers. Yeah. Props won't see you for
and
a
when,
while.
When they first, I mean, the desk sergeant, who recognises him because, you know, he's by now quite well known, jumps over the counter and he's still on the mobile phone, and they start to handcuff him. He's still conducting the
phone call.
Is this a man who has no...
Who dates a man like that, ladies?
Well, I think we've been through this one before, haven't we?
Yeah.
It is an interesting one.
No one's saying, well, I'm not, I mean, I don't know if he was abusive to women or not, but just like, he's just a downright bad un.
Yes.
100% bad guy.
Yes, and this is not someone, as I said at the beginning, darling, who is hiding in plain sight. This is not some inoffensive character who secretly conducts terrible crime.
He looks bad and he is bad.
He looks bad, is bad. He does exactly what it says on the tin. Okay, the interesting point is what happens next.
What happened?
He pleads not guilty.
Oh, of course he did. Cool. Just to those crimes or the other two?
Oh, all four murders.
Oh, great.
And
cool.
The three attempted.
Oh, cool, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he gets what he wants, which is a major trial.
Because he wants to be famous.
Because he wants to be famous. Which begins on the 4th of February 2013. It costs £5 million, the most expensive criminal trial in recent British history.
Why is it so expensive?
Because there are police marksmen. He's transported in all a convoy of cars.
Oh, sugar, he needs so much protection because of what he did as well.
That's right. However, being Cregan, He manipulates the court. He decides, after about 4 days, the hearing started, that he'll plead guilty to the two police women, but he won't plead guilty to the shorts. Okay. So okay. Then the trial goes on a little further. He pleads guilty to the shorts. But now, of course, the money's spent. He's got various co-accused in the dock with him, people who've also been involved in some of the shootings, but not in the police women. Finally, he is convicted. By one mad irony, he'd attacked another friend of the shorts with a hand grenade, and the jury found him not guilty because there was insufficient evidence. So they cleared him of that, but he has by now pleaded guilty to the four murders, and he's found guilty of the three attempted in the Cotton Tree pub. The judge's remarks are, as you would expect, damning. He's shown not, as we were so familiar with, not one morsel of remorse, not one iota of regret, and he's given a whole life term.
Proper one.
A proper whole life term. He will never escape from prison.
I bet he's mean in prison.
Well, I think it is extraordinary in that it is so horrifying. I think it's worth it was a psychiatrist came up with an explanation which I've always found very convincing.
Uh-huh.
Grandiosity is central to the behaviour of psychopaths because usually their lives are quite pathetic, empty and meaningless. So they have to create a very distorted sense of their own self-worth. The other side of that is that other people are not important to them.
Oh, that makes sense.
Then, about the same time, the then chief constable of Greater Manchester said that he believed that Cregan wanted to be seen as a folk hero. I do think that was part of his plan, trying to get the hero status. He handed himself in because he feared that if he engaged with police officers, he would have been shot. That's why he desperately got into the car and raced to the station.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, it kind of makes sense.
It does. But the horrifying aspect is the damage it did to the families of the two officers he killed.
Using human life to get famous is... I struggle with that.
I quote Nicola Hughes's father. He chose on that day to murder our daughter and leave our lives completely devastated. A life barely worth living without her. In fact, he went on to create a victims' charity and raise a great deal of money. I think the most telling phrase he used, he has lost nothing. He had already committed two murders and was destined for a lifetime behind bars. Fiona Bone's father, Paul, said in a victim statement and outside the court, they say it gets easier in time, but at this moment, every Tuesday lunchtime is difficult, as that is when our lives changed forever.
So sad.
Cregan is now, of course, famous.
Is he in the Monster Mansion?
No, he was in strange ways. It's now called HM Prison Manchester. But of course, being Cregan, anxious ever to have a grand opinion of himself, he goes on a hunger strike and gets sent to Ashworth Secure Hospital.
What for?
Because he got someone to certify him as being insane.
Oh, come off it.
He wasn't insane. If it's any consolation, he then bragged when he was Ashworth that he did kayaking and got pizza, which leaked out. I mean, it's bizarre and it's funny, but if it weren't so tragic... He's now back in HM Prison, Manchester. But one of the things that I find chilling, one of the many about Cregan, is that what has he got to lose? He could kill a prisoner without a moment's command. What can they do?
Nothing.
Can't do any more to me than they've already done.
No.
And I'd like to come back to that as these go on, because there are a couple of very interesting cases.
Oh, we said we were going to look at killing prisoners in prison.
Yeah.
Prisoners killing other prisoners.
Yes, because it's a very interesting phenomenon. And one of the problems of the whole life term, and again, very interesting, neither parent of the two police women who were killed asked for the return of the death penalty. Both of them specifically said they didn't want the death penalty.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know how many people in the UK would want the death penalty now.
I don't know.
I don't believe in the death penalty.
No.
But I don't believe in any kind of punishment. That, I mean, it's already bad enough. Like, I started listening to this really amazing podcast called Ear Hustle. I would highly recommend it. It's made by a guy in prison, and it's just stories about what it's like to be in prison and stuff. Holy moly, I just heard on there that, like, when the three strikes rule came in the US, if you did something bad, so, like, this one guy, he'd, like, committed two smallish crimes. The third crime he committed was stealing two $20 bills out of a drawer in a liquor store. He didn't shoot anyone. He never laid hands on anyone ever in any of his crimes, ever in his whole life. He was given 50 years to life.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was the third strike.
Three strikes and you're out.
That is crazy. There's people in prison who haven't done anything like really that bad who are in there for that long. That is bananas.
But very American.
It's American, like, literally, you could have, like, a tiny bag of weed on you or meth or whatever drugs people take in America, and they put you in prison for life. That is insane.
Oh, we're making America great again.
That freaks me out so much. Like, it scares me so much that prison sentencing could be so awful. Like, ugh.
I would just pose the small moral conundrum. If you are going to reject the death penalty, or the needle, as it would be in the States, or the electric chair, I understand that. And some states have rejected it and some have kept it. Here we rejected it for many good reasons, including the possibility of executing an innocent man or woman. But it is a very complicated moral question. And however... which I do not think Dale Cregan, or Cregan, actually asks. He deserves the entire sentence. He does not deserve to be allowed out of prison. That crime is so horrible.
No, never. He doesn't ever deserve to be allowed out of prison. Ever, 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 ever. You know, guys, if you want to write to us or tweet us or anything and let us know how you feel about that, please do, because it is an ongoing issue for us.
Yes, and it's also very important to think, are we being too... I sometimes worry, oh, this is a bit too gross, or are there too many details? Should I...
I don't think the details are the problem. I think people like the details, but I think that I think the moral questions are like, that's the big one.
I think, well, there are a lot of interesting moral questions, and we will come on to those.
We will. Anyway, that was Dale Cregan, or Cregan, the one-eyed gangster. So we should talk about something jolly. Oh, who we're going to do in 2 weeks' time? Dad's always decided.
We're going to do Mark Bridger.
Mark Bridger.
Who abducted and was convicted of killing a little Welsh girl with wonderful blonde hair called April Jones. In a manhunt that was probably the most famous in recent memory.
I remember it because one of my clients at the time, who sadly no longer my client, was filming that TV show Broadchurch.
Yeah.
And she was really cross because it was like, it was in Wales, wasn't it? They were in Bristol, and she was like literally just a... I hope everyone's seen the first series of... They were doing an investigation into something that happened to a child, and she was like, and across the county, something really has happened that's really bad.
Yeah.
I don't know why she was angry. I think she was more angry because she wasn't really enjoying working on the TV show than specifically it being the fault of the television show that they were dumbing down real television, real life. But yeah, there you go. That's what I remember it a bit more vividly because of that.
So let's talk about something cheerful. What's the week hold?
Well, I told you already I'm going to all the theatres.
Are you going to the theatre, yes. What am I doing? I'm going to... I very, very rarely go to publishers' parties, but I'm going to one tonight for a book written by a friend called Bob Marshall Andrews, used to be Labour MP, still a silk, which is a very interesting thriller set on the shores of Lake Tanganyika. Now, Bob's very interested in chimpanzees.
Where's Tanganyika?
Call it the middle of Africa.
Okay.
Right in the middle. Anyway, this is a this fictional background is that there is a station established on the shores of Lake Tanganyika to study the behaviour of chimpanzees. And a man who hasn't been there for 10 years, an Oxford professor of anthropology, goes to visit and discovers that chimpanzees are suddenly being murdered.
And something's going down in Chimpanzeeville.
Yeah, well, which is not a chimpanzee behaviour.
Well, they're not murder. Do you know that chimpanzees are actually murderous? They actually kill, like, if one chimpanzee gang finds another one, they will kill each other.
Well, this is the premise of the story. And Bob casts the story so that a particular rogue chimpanzee who's been nicknamed Dump.
That's not the kindest name I've ever heard.
As inciting rebellion.
In the chimpanzee gang. I'll just read the book. But I mean, do you mean like the murdering of the chimpanzees is like it's generally felt that it's the chimpanzee doing the murdering?
That's right.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
And of course, it's not a coincidence that today is the first anniversary of the installation of Donald Trump as the United States president.
Oh, Jeffrey. Oh, Dump. Okay, right. Sorry. I've got it. Took me a while to clock on there.
And it is both a political satire and a very good thriller.
Excellent.
And it's, and as I say, I very, very seldom go. But I did like this, and it's very clever.
And he's your friend.
And he's a friend. And if you get a chance, it's not a very big publisher called White Fox. But if you
What's the book called?
It's called Dump.
It's called Dump. Yes. Okay, cool. Is it out yet? Do we know?
It is out.
It's out.
And on Amazon and on all the usual places and in all the usual places. But so that's one thing I'm doing. And I'm not doing anything else very dramatic as far as I know, apart from seeing you.
Oh, yes. Well, we have lunch, won't we, on Saturday. My client Coral's going to come. She's been, I told you, she's the one that did the short film about, she wrote and starred in a short film about a serial killer who finds her victims on Tinder.
Yes.
She's very excited to talk to you about it, so get ready.
I will. I'm already.
I'll send it to you. I'll send you the film to watch as well. Yeah,
that'd be good. I'd like to have a look at it.
I will. I will do, for sure. She's the one that told me about all the other good podcasts to listen to, too. I listened to a really interesting one about pornography that John Ronson did, which I really enjoyed, called The Butterfly Effect, if you're interested in
well,
listening.
Well, yeah. If I just type in The Butterfly Effect, I'll get it.
I'll send you the link.
Okay. And I hope the most important thing, I think, is that you get a bit better.
Yeah, I would like to be better now.
That your health improves.
It's very difficult for me to do my job without a voice. Not this job. My podcasting, obviously, is hard with no voice, but my actual primary job is very difficult without a voice.
Anyway, get well soon.
Thanks so much. Thanks, everyone. We will see you in 2 weeks' time.